president goes looking for more stimulus.
But what's left for the administration to do?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York, in for Bill Radke today. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, September 7th.
President Obama this week is rolling out new proposals to help revive the economy and create some jobs. Europe, economically, is the new U.S. And studying for a test? Well, who cares if your Facebook friend just went to the grocery store? But first,
another day, another economic stimulus idea from the White House. The latest plan to speed up a tax break for companies to build new factories and buy equipment like computers and tractors. We're joined by Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington. Good morning, Scott.
Jeremy, good morning.
Well, we heard about that big plan for infrastructure spending yesterday. What are the details of the latest proposal?
Well, when a company buys new stuff, typically it can write off those costs over several years, sometimes even 20 years, depending on what the stuff is. This proposal says you can take the whole deduction up front. So this is a cash flow thing, money in their pockets now instead of later, if they spend it on plants and equipment, the things that Uncle Sam wants. Now, the administration says this is going to give businesses $200 billion that they'd otherwise be paying in taxes. So if you're for it, you argue that this creates jobs and contracts for the people who make stuff, like bulldozers and computers. If you're against it, you argue this may not change much. Companies already have access to cheap credit to invest, and they may not do it unless sales actually pick up, Jeremy.
So good arguments for and against. Can this get through Congress, though, Scott?
Well, key business lobbying groups have already given an initial "it smells good" kind of sense, but. And the but is what they really want is something else, to extend the income tax cuts on wealthier Americans that expire soon. So everyone is posturing, and we can expect that throughout the fall campaign. Tomorrow, the president speaks again about the economy in Cleveland.
Okay, Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, September 7th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. Today's Wall Street Journal reports banks in Europe aren't as healthy as they claim. Many of them underwent stress tests a couple of months ago, similar to what American banks did last year. The paper says a lot of those banks are holding more risky debt from countries such as Greece. But there's also consensus on fixing a European economy shaken to its roots not too long ago. Finance ministers from the 27 countries that make up the European Union agreed to drastic financial reforms. For one, they would identify problems in countries before those countries engulf the entire region. And that, in many economists' eyes, underscores Europe's better economic place than even here in the United States. A role reversal of sorts, the BBC's Ben Shore reports.
President Barroso is confident that the European Union is in better shape than it was a year ago. It's a welcome change for Europe, which for months has been the sick man of the world economy. Greek debt plunged the region into crisis and raised fears the euro currency would collapse. And President Barroso acknowledged huge challenges ahead.
Our work is far from finished. There is no room for complacency. Namely, the problem of unemployment is an extremely serious problem.
While the economic picture in the US is getting worse right now, growth in the EU will be higher this year than initially forecast. Nevertheless, no one is kidding themselves the region's out of the woods just yet. In Brussels, I'm the BBC's Ben Shaw for Marketplace.
Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. She's here to give us some analysis this morning. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So some doubt cast on the accuracy of those European stress tests. Is this a surprise to you?
Well, this is an old story because everybody thought that the European stress tests were a little fluffy to begin with. Ours was positively rigorous by comparison. Bottom line is they didn't allow for higher unemployment, sovereign debt default. Everybody knew that Germany was bankrolling the entire economic community there. How willing would they be continue on with it? Greece can't pay back their debt in 3 years when the bailout ends. That's $960 billion that they've already flushed down Europe already. Now, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Ireland Switzerland and the rest of the Club Med countries start to follow, they've got huge problems. So they're going to have to start really cranking up interest rates at this point for all those countries.
Well, you say ours were rigorous compared to theirs, but are ours in doubt now?
No, they really weren't. You know, bottom line is what we're looking at is it didn't allow for economic conditions that weren't going to recover. And my argument all the way along has been that we're not out of this recession by a long stretch. In fact, it would be an official double-dip recession if we saw sovereign debt default because their banking system would drag us back down again. So we haven't allowed for the probability that unemployment was going to get higher, and it is, that our asset base was going to continue to deteriorate, real estate is still going down. In other words, the recession is not over. We've got to batten down the hatches for round two.
And quickly, Julie, I mean, we've got the markets down today after several good days on Wall Street. It seemed like the recovery was back on track. Now, all of a sudden, this story in the Wall Street Journal, and everything's going south again. Should we have some questions about the future of our recovery in the U.S.?
Well, this year-old market rally was really based only on one thing. There was no other place to put the money. The Fed and interest rates effectively at zero right now. There's little borrowing or lending going on. Real estate, you're lucky if you have a 10-year time horizon if you want to buy that. Gold at $1,200 an ounce. Commodities, only if you really believe vigorous growth is about to resume. So by default, stocks have been the place to put the money. But the traders have been moving it from sector to sector. It's quite volatile. That's where the money is, and the money will flow back out again. So it's not
okay.
A real rally.
Julie, thanks so much.
You bet.
Julie Neiman, an analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis.
President Obama's top economic advisor, Larry Summers, this week is in Beijing. Summers is trying to encourage China to strengthen its currency. But will that do anything to help the U.S. economy? Here's Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
Between 2005 and 2008, China increased the value of its currency more than 20% against the dollar. There was hardly any impact on the U.S. economy. So why is Larry Summers in Beijing to try and convince the Chinese to appreciate its currency further?
This issue is completely unimportant to the economic future of the United States or the rest of the world.
China economist Andy Rothman says Summers' China trip is a sign the Obama administration is caving into pressure from Congress. Democrats are trying to pass legislation that would pressure China to appreciate its currency. Lawmakers and other economists say a more valuable yuan would revive U.S. manufacturing. Economist Rothman doesn't buy it.
The best that the Chinese government can do for the global recovery is to keep doing what they've been doing, winding down the huge stimulus that has worked and keep GDP growth on track for roughly 8 or 9% growth next year. That'll be a big help to everybody.
Rothman says more Chinese consumers mean more U.S. exports, and that's already happening. In the first 6 months of this year, U.S. exports to China increased 36%. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The British bank Barclays has announced its next CEO, but Bob Diamond already seemingly has a couple of strikes against him going in. One thing, he's an American. And number two, he's head of the company's investment banking arm. A job announcement could be controversial on both sides of the Atlantic, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us. He's live with us now from London to talk about the appointment. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
All right, so let's handle the criticism one by one. If he's an American, why is he getting flack from the U.S.?
Well, he's controversial in some quarters in the U.S. for, as it was said at the time, swooping like a vulture, picking up some of the remnants of Lehman Brothers after the crash for a song. And it was claimed he unfairly deprived Lehman shareholders of billions of dollars worth of assets.
And let's go to the other side of the Atlantic, Stephen. What's his problem over in London?
Well, here, he's widely seen as the epitome of what went wrong on Wall Street and in London during the boom years. He is an investment banker to his fingertips. He built up Barclays' investment wing from scratch, made himself immensely wealthy in the process. And although Barclays survived the bust, Diamond is associated with that so-called casino capitalism, you know, which has been portrayed as greedy, only concerned with a fast buck, not with providing finance for real businesses.
Yeah, greed is good. Okay, but why did he get the job then? I mean, he must be doing something right.
Oh, yeah. Well, Barclays shareholders have every reason to be happy with Diamond. His division provided 90% of Barclays' profits last year. And Michael Prest, an independent commentator here, says some of those other investment banking titans on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, who've been treated rather as pariahs of late, would also be happy about Diamond's promotion.
they'll see Bob Dahman's appointment as a sign that business will be going back to usual, or at least that many of the criticisms which have been levelled against them have been exaggerated or even completely unjustified.
Diamond is scheduled to take over the top job at Barclays next March.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting this morning from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
President of ABC News David Weston is stepping down at the end of the year. He's been at the helm for 13 years there. He announced his resignation in an email last night. Weston oversaw the death of anchor Peter Jennings, a shuffling in the anchor chair at World News, among other big changes there. The biggest news under his term there, the layoff of 400 workers earlier this year. Weston told colleagues he wants to pursue other things, but an insider say he was forced out, partly because ABC News is second place in the ratings, partly because the division doesn't make as much money as parent Walt Disney Company would like. Aaron Barnhart is a television critic over at Kansas City Star in Missouri. He's with us live this morning from Kansas City. Good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, did this come as a surprise?
A surprise in the sense that the news was sudden, but in another sense, probably not. I've been on the beat for 13 years, and David Weston is the only ABC News president I've had. And in that time, enough issues have percolated up, particularly lately, about whether his leadership was positioning ABC News for the future.
And he had some big shoes to fill in Rune Arledge, right, who created Monday Night Football, and there was a lot of money to be made in all of that, right?
And the thing that Rune Arledge did, and this was always the rap on Weston, was that Rune thought out of the box and Rune took chances. He spent a lot of money on anchors. He reinvented the look and feel of ABC News. And it's hard to say point at any one thing that Weston did other than launch a service called ABC News Now that nobody I know can get.
Yeah, well, there is no cable network. Yeah. So I mean, what were the criticisms of Weston by Disney execs?
And the cable news factors into that, Steve. I think that one of the things that Weston did not do was proactively think about where ABC News needed to go. Without that kind of vision, it could very quickly become a CBS News division, which is a much smaller version of ABC News.
Yeah, the perennial third place, right?
Yeah, and cable news in particular is going to be a real sore spot. NBC is number one in mornings, they're number one in evenings, and they have a cable news partner. It allows them to look a lot bigger than just the broadcast network. And Weston was criticized for never pursuing talks with CNN. About the only thing he did was bring over Christiane Amanpour and pay her a lot of money just at a time when he was laying off all those people. So he was criticized for that, too.
All right, Aaron Barnhart, TV critic of the Kansas City Star. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update from Monday, September 7th. I'm Jeremy Hobson, in for Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. A lot of people check out Consumer Reports when they're buying a dishwasher or TV. Now the magazine's rating some doctors' groups that perform heart surgery. Why the cardiac captivation? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
The rankings are based on patient survival rates, doctors' surgical techniques, and medications. Dr. John Santa directs the Consumer Reports Health Ratings Center. He says there's a shortage of reliable doctor rankings.
That it is easier for consumers to find out information about cars and flat screens than it is to find out the very basic information about doctors and hospitals.
But some people say take the rankings with a grain of salt. Austin Frecht is a health economist at Boston University. He says the doctor's grade depends partly on how their patients do. What about the doctor who takes on the oldest and sickest patients?
And he's so good and so kind, he wants to take care of the patients that are hardest to treat. And so his or her quality rating looks low when really it's very high quality care.
There are about 1,000 cardiac doctor groups around the country. Consumer Reports only ranked about 200. It's hoping to expand its rankings. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
To Detroit now, where earlier this year, Mayor Dave Bing suggested moving some of the city's residents from blighted neighborhoods to other parts of the city. Detroit is trying to save money on services in areas that are largely abandoned. But the proposal didn't go over well with some residents. And now, as Sarah Hewlett reports from Michigan Radio, Mayor Bing is trying a different tack.
It's a kinder, gentler approach than Mayor Bing initially took. Back in February, he predicted there would be winners and losers as the city looked to scale back services like trash pickup and street maintenance to better align with Detroit's declining population. The city spends nearly $3 billion a year on municipal services, and Detroit is struggling to close an $85 million deficit. Bing's comments prompted an uproar over the prospect of forced relocations and drew comparisons in one of the city's newspapers to the treatment of Native Americans in the Trail of Tears. Bing now promises eminent domain is off the table. Marja Winters is the deputy director of Detroit's Planning and Development Department.
I think there's a large level of mistrust, and I think that we have to build credibility and we have to regain confidence and trust in government.
Winters will help oversee a 12 to 18 month process to come up with a strategic plan for how the city deals with major issues, including land use, housing, and transportation. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
News this morning from the Wall Street Journal about some skepticism over a Google takeover of the online travel software company ITA. ITA is used by fare compare sites like Kayak and Orbitz. Well, competitors are questioning whether Google would exert too much control over the travel industry if the deal goes through. By the way, Google is expanding in other ways and hiring. But before you punch up your resume and start looking for an apartment in Silicon Valley, you should know that a big part of Google's expansion is happening in Pittsburgh. Mark Newtbar of WDUQ has the story.
Google has more than 100 employees housed in a small building on the Carnegie Mellon University campus. It's bursting at the seams, so the company is about to move 2 miles down the street. Google first partnered with Carnegie Mellon in 2006. Rick McCullough is the vice president for research at the school.
A lot of universities thought that we were insane to have companies polluting, you know, the purity of the ivory tower in the academics. And that turns out to be, you know, what we believe is the future of research.
The engineering manager at Google's Pittsburgh office is Kamal Nigam. He relies on those close ties to Carnegie Mellon.
Some of our software engineers teach classes at CMU. We have faculty who come and do sabbatical with us. We have joint lecture series. We hire interns.
Carnegie Mellon continues to attract big names to its campus, including Intel, Apple, and Disney. McCullough says every company has different standards for sharing intellectual property, funding, and staff.
We don't make partnerships with all corporations. We handpick the ones we want to partner with, the ones that are really, really difficult to work with on intellectual property and legal issues. We walk away.
Carnegie Mellon's not alone in getting tech companies here. There's also the Pittsburgh Technology Council. Its leader is Audrey Russo, who says having bigger names in town really helps attract other firms.
It just changes the plane of the conversation in terms of our credibility.
Andy Quayle has bought what Russo was trying to sell. Quayle came to the States from the Isle of Man and eventually settled in Pittsburgh, where he launched an internet solutions company. He sits in a Starbucks in a waterfront entertainment district that once hosted a 2-mile-long steel mill.
People are coming into town, they're like, wow, Pittsburgh is definitely not what I imagined it would be. There's a whole lot of tech in Pittsburgh. There's startups coming up all over the place. There's incubator labs. The talent we got here, there's a whole lot of talent in Pittsburgh.
Crail says Pittsburgh is becoming the Silicon Valley of the East, so much so that he's launched the blog techburg.com. I'm Mark Newtbar for Marketplace.
Congress gets back to work after a summer and holiday break. There are only 2 more months until the November election. We thought we'd test our knowledge of current events and public affairs once again, as we do every so often, and we're glad to bring in Stefan Richter with this morning's Marketplace Globalist Quiz. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Steve. Ready for today's quiz?
I am.
Of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, what's the share of millionaires? Is it A, less than 10%? B, close to half of all the members of Congress, or C, even 2/3 of the members of Congress?
Well, I know they call the Senate the Millionaires Club.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's 100 of them right there.
Uh-huh.
I would say somewhere half.
Half is a brilliant answer.
Ah.
But since you talked about the Senate, you should have gone for two-thirds are actually millionaires.
So, Stefan, I'm curious about how much, you know, what's the comparison between how much the lawmakers make and the rest of us make in this country?
The median U.S. family has a net worth of about $120,000. For the average member of the U.S. House of Representatives, it's $666,000. Hmm. So that goes to show that in terms of the representativeness of the U.S. Congress, there's a lot of rich people there and very few average folks.
Well, I'm headed to Washington then. That's where the money is, Stefan.
That is probably truer than we all wish for.
And thanks for providing us with that insight, Stefan.
It was my pleasure, dollar for dollar.
Stefan Richter is publisher and editor-in-chief of The Globalist. To learn more about the global economy, politics, and culture, visit theglobalist.com. A story kids may not want their parents to hear. A new study of students finds that exam scores for people who have Facebook running on their computer, even just in the background, are about 20% lower than those who are not using Facebook.
But Steve, the authors of this study did not look into the effects of the marketplace Facebook page. So until they do, remember that we are always happy to distract you online.
Indeed we are. And finally, the European low-cost carrier Ryanair is at it again.
The carrier's CEO, Michael O'Leary, says he can offer even lower fares by getting rid of the plane's co-pilot. Mm. O'Leary told Bloomberg Businessweek, if something happens to the captain, let the bloody computer fly it.
Yeah, of course. There are hazards to that business model, Jeremy, like when the main pilot is unable to do his job.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
No. Not that. Ryanair says, no problem. Like in the movie Airplane, the flight attendant, or I think anyway, Jeremy, even a passenger can step into action if need be. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.